Hello, and welcome to this podcast of Big Data, Small Politics, Algorithmic Regulation and Its Pitfalls, a talk delivered by Evgeny Morozov at Santa Clara University on April 10, 2014. Evgeny Morozov is a writer and a key critical voice in the conversation about the Internet's role in society. The primary target of his critique has been what he has called the ideology of Internet centrism. It is this ideology that he has skewered in two books, The Net Delusion and To Save Everything, Click Here, as well as in various articles in The New Republic, The New York Times, The Economist, The Wall Street Journal, and numerous other publications. Last year, a New York Times article called Morozov the most prominent, most multi-platform critic of the utopian promises coming from Silicon Valley. Morozov is currently pursuing a PhD in the history of science, and he frequently writes about ethical implications of technology, including the new drive toward algorithmic regulation.
Thank you so much, and it's a pleasure to be here. I have no idea what the New York Times meant by saying that I'm multi-platformed. Maybe that I use email and Twitter, and that counts. So what I'll do today is I don't think I'll be talking a lot about internet centrism and internet ideology, which is something I've written quite a lot. Instead, I will focus on the political and ethical and moral issues surrounding big data and the internet of things and sensors of various kinds. For those of you who might want to live before I finish, I'll just lay out my argument very fast at the very beginning, and then I'll complicate as I move on. So essentially, I'll be making several points. Point number one, the proliferation of sensors and various means to capture data, store data, and analyze data in real time, what we call big data, will result not just in huge economic and political shifts, it will also introduce a new way of seeing the world, a new way of talking about politics, a new way of perceiving things out there. So the impact will be epistemological and not just political. That in itself, I think, the ways in which the types of data that we gather and the types of data that we analyze and how that in turn affects what kind of entities we see and how we distribute responsibility will profoundly affect how we regulate. It will profoundly affect how we make decisions about where to assign blame, where to assign responsibility, who to hold responsible for the problems that are happening out in the world. Some people refer to this more and more, especially in Silicon Valley, under the name of algorithmic regulation, and I will unpack that as we move on. I'll conclude more or less by trying to articulate what an alternative paradigm might be that will still be data intensive and that will still not shy away from technology and sensors and algorithms, but will not engage in the kind of political project that I associate with algorithmic regulation. So those are the three propositions I'll try to defend today. So with regards to the first part of my argument, what I think we are seeing, and for many of you, this will be a picture that is well known, especially if you follow trends here in the Valley, is that more and more of our lives are increasingly being tracked, they're being monitored, they're being tracked and monitored through the devices that we carry, but they're also being tracked and monitored by various sensors and systems that are not designed by us and are not even perceivable by us. All of that creates a huge data trail. All of that, of course, results in proliferation of databases that we, again, do not even suspect that they exist. All of that allows for new forms of analysis, right? All of that allows for new forms of analyzing behavior, right? So, and you can see that happen across many different fields. So it's not, I would actually argue that the kind of epistemological shifts that we are seeing, they're not just common to Silicon Valley. If you follow discourses outside of the digital technology, you will see a similar mode at work among people who talk about the virtues of behavioral economics. You will see the same kind of rhetorical argument made by people who are fascinated by randomized control trials. All of them more or less share the same kind of excitement about the ability to monitor what it is that we individual users or citizens or students or recipients of healthcare or, you know, any other kinds of objects of regulation do, how we behave, taking that data, processing it, and identifying various inconsistencies in our behavior that might be corrected by nudging us, for example, as behavioral economists would do, to do things differently. Right? And again, I just want to make it clear that much of this epistemological shift is enabled precisely by the proliferation of new informational technological communications infrastructure that allows for immediate real-time monitoring of basically every act of behavior that we engage in. Right? So the reason why it is possible for somebody to monitor, you know, how we walk, how much we exercise, or how much, what kind of food we eat, or how much energy we consume. All of that, of course, is possible only because we are surrounded by infrastructure that is no longer dumb, but is smart, right? It has a way to capture certain traces of our behavior, analyze it on the spot, process it, and then upload it to some database where it can be analyzed against some of the other traces of our behavior, someone else's behavior, right? So what that allows, in turn, is to perceive, again, how we deviate from some objective formal type of what counts as good behavior, right? So it becomes possible to compare, for example, whether we are following the right diet, whether we are following the right exercise routine, whether we are consuming energy in properly or improperly. All of those types of analysis again become possible as the means to capture and analyze data become possible as well, right? And the fact that it's not just the sensors but also the screens, it's also the fact that it's not just that the data is being captured, it's that it's being fed back to us, right? And it's being fed to us through screens of our iPhones, it's being fed to us through social networking sites, it's being fed to us through all sorts of other devices that, you know, we'll be surrounded with, whether it's the smart glasses of Google, or whether it's the self-driving cars, or whether it's anything that has a screen and an interface, can essentially be deployed for that purpose of real-time analytics, where the system is trying to understand what it is that you do, and then feed this information back to you with the goal of having you change your behavior. Right? That essentially, I think, is the project that can explain a lot of the recent apps and a lot of the recent projects we're seeing that emerge out of the quantified self movement, much of it based here and also in places like Boston, particularly around topics like health, and to some extent sleep, and then a few others. But I would argue that's more or less the same kind of logic and rhetoric that now more and more informs people who do economics, for example, behavioral economics especially. Now you see more and more the same type of solutions being applied to tackle personal finance, for example. Right? So since, again, we are increasingly using our smartphones, which again have sensors and a link to the rest of this analytical infrastructure to pay for goods, it becomes possible to analyze whether we are spending more or less than a portion of our income should be, and, you know, new types of apps come on the scene that tell you that, you know, you cannot actually afford to buy that latte because it sort of deviates from the usual spending pattern that you should be on if you don't want to, you know, become poor, or, you know, whatever the ultimate sort of fear is, right? So again, you see already a number of such apps which are being offered, but if you closely follow some of the discourse around poverty right now and some of the ways to tackle it, there is much more and more excitement about mobile phones, particularly for this reason. And it's the fact that you will be able to monitor the spending patterns of the populations who might not yet be in full control of their own finances, and then quietly but cleverly nudge them to spend differently, right? And it's, again, the same kind of logic you see in a different type of economic projects. You might have seen that last year a book came out that argued basically that based on a lot of experimental data, we found out that poor people, for example, have a lot of difficulty in filling in different forms for asking for aid, right? Again, it can happen because you can now monitor, since there are sensors everywhere, you can actually monitor actual behavior. And since you detect that poor people just don't have the time because they have to work too much to study and understand all those forms, they're missing out on a lot of potential benefits, right? So the kind of solution that emerges as a sort of favorite solution based on this monitoring technique is, of course, to redesign the forms, right? So what do? We simplify the forms. We understand how the cognitive processes, since we know how to study them and we know how to monitor them, we redesign the environment in order to have it match the cognitive skills or perceptions of the users, right? And I would argue that it's the same response that you actually see in the kind of data that is generated by all those other apps that monitor your diet or that monitor your exercise activity or that monitor your sleep or that monitor your energy consumption. The kind of truth or the kind of statements that emerge out of those apps essentially revolve around the user. They revolve around the individual. Why? Because that's the unit of analysis in which we operate, right? Because the data that we gather, by almost definition, monitors your activity as a user, right? So we monitor how much you exercise, we monitor how much you eat, we monitor how much energy you consume, as if whatever problems that exist in your life are solely the outcome of your own personal decisions or failings, right? So the implicit assumption, which is often built into many of those apps, is that the reason why, for example, there is obesity or poverty or climate change or any other types of problems in the world is that because we as citizens and cognitive agents fail to take the right steps in changing our own behaviors to avoid those problems. So what we need to do is to change to a different diet, or we need to start engaging in more exercise, or we need to stop consuming much more energy at home, or we need to basically redesign the forms. And, you know, that's more or less the paradigm in which the toolkit for solutions for these problems is presented to us, right? And again, I just want to emphasize that the reason why the problem, the solutions are presented in this particular way partly follows from the fact that the data that we gather, we don't gather it at any systemic level, at any structural level at which some of those problems are caused, right? We are not subjecting some of the giant food companies that might be responsible for the problem of obesity in this country to the same kind of detailed data analysis that we are subjecting ourselves to, right? So, of course, the kind of solutions that emerge based on our analysis, they by default favor the smallest units through which we gather the data, which is the citizen, right? So the kind of political prescription that emerges based on many of these innovations in data collection, by default, already promotes a certain kind of politics, which, in my opinion, is a very narrow politics, and it's a very narrow in the sense that it more or less keeps the system itself, whatever system you want to imagine behind some of those problems, as intact. And not just intact, but also almost impervious to any tinkering and regulation or configuration. All you can do is to change the users themselves, right? That's why it becomes possible to put more and more responsibility on the shoulders of the citizens, right? Again, through the continuous process of monitoring what we do, analyzing it, how it compares to some imagined norm, and feeding that data back to us, right? In an ideal world, I think, we would not be fighting poverty by redesigning the forms, right? We would be fighting poverty by engaging in some kind of structural reform efforts, right, to actually eradicate the root causes of poverty. Of course, the immediate response to some of this critique is to say that none of the solutions are being presented to us as being only about doing politics at the level of the individual. I would argue that, that's, however, is incorrect. And we have to look at the relative distribution of solutions, if you will, at the government level. If you look at the reception of, for example, behavioral economics and nudging, which is the paradigm that informs many of these interventions behind apps and quantified self and so forth, there is clearly a very huge shift. There is a lot of interest, and there is more and more government resources, at least, for example, in Europe. You have an entire huge government unit in the British government, the Behavioral Economics Unit, which now actually became a for-profit unit and split off from the government, whose entire job is to remake politics and remake policymaking along those lines. Right? So again, I would argue that the only way to understand why there is such an appeal for this kind of small, narrow interventions that take the system as a given and then try to change the user or put at least all the burden of problem solving on the shoulders of the user, it has to do with certain shifts in how we think about politics, right? And yeah, I don't want to go into a long discussion of neoliberalism, but there is a certain affinity between the kind of configurations we see that are enabled by the perpetual monitoring of citizens and the kind of governance logic that a lot of political theorists would associate with neoliberal regimes. That aside, I think we have to understand how some of this now is also leading to the emergence of an entire paradigm that, as I've said, some already dub algorithmic regulation, and the most prominent person to have done so so far is Tim O'Reilly, who you might know as a very prominent publisher and investor and a writer who a few years ago published a short essay and then he developed into a long essay about algorithmic regulation, where the goal is more or less to present some of the innovations we are seeing in Silicon Valley, particularly in terms of how companies like Google operate and how they continuously take the interactions with the users. So the more you search, the better the search results get, as a kind of paradigm for how we can actually change and remake our government. So Tim O'Reilly, in his essay on algorithmic regulation, just to stick with him for a while, outlines four factors that for him define what make a system, a good candidate for algorithmic regulation. And for him, those four factors are that the system should have a very well understood and a clear set of goals. It should have the ability to monitor and make adjustments in real time. It should have the ability to deploy some kind of algorithms for automating some of those adjustments. And there should be some kind of a meta level where we can actually understand whether the adjustments you are making actually contributing to the initial goal that you have set up for yourself in the first step. And you know, many of the examples that he gives of how this paradigm already works in certain areas of the government, in few areas of the government, to me, make me very suspicious and make me ask a lot of questions. Because, for example, one of the paradigmatic examples of how this paradigm already operates in the U.S. government, for him, is how the Federal Reserve and many other central banks outside of America, how they essentially try to constantly learn about what's happening with money supply, and then tinker with the rates that they set in order to achieve whatever goal it is that they hold, right? And the argument that he's making is that it's basically a very good embodiment of algorithmic regulation, because there is continuous feedback coming from the market that then informs how the Federal Reserve decides to go about their activities. Of course, if you only think about it theoretically, without knowing anything about what's actually currently happening in financial markets, that might seem like a very ideal picture of algorithmic regulation, right? Which is dynamic, which is real time, which instead of producing laws that are set in stone and that seek to achieve some permanent objectives, is always dynamic and is always responsive to perturbations in the social and political system. I mean, for a lot of people, including people like Tim O'Reilly, highly, and he says so explicitly, that's the paradigm according to which we want to more or less remake our government, right? But the problem, of course, is that once you leave the theoretical field behind and you actually look at the reality of things, you'll know that probably most of the central banks right now no longer have any autonomy, and their own actions are more or less constrained by the money-creating activities of banks on Wall Street and elsewhere, right? So unless you manage to incorporate those structural constraints into a model, you might think that, you know, central banks actually have far more authority over the governance of our lives and of governance of the economy than they actually do. I mean, there are a lot of people making the very opposite case, that they're there only to more or less serve the interests of the current financial system, right? All I'm trying to say with this example is that depending on the existing view of the political situation that you start with, and depending on what your view of the current structural problems that hurt the economy, the kind of perspective you're going to develop on algorithmic regulation will be very different, right? And it might very well be that if our only criteria for assessing how algorithmic regulation works is how dynamically and how fast the system can adapt itself to its supposed targets, right? And if we just judge it by the efficiency and the time response and the amount of time that passes before the system fully reconfigures itself, we're actually going to miss the actual political and social and economic transformations that are also happening that actually result not in us, but in someone else setting up the very goals for the system, right? And in order to detect who's setting up those goals, you need to have some kind of basic theory of politics. You do need to have some kind of political and social analysis that will be able to tell you what's good and what's bad, right? And a lot of the analysis that we see that is being celebrated for its efficiency, its creative adaptation, its dynamic adaptation, and so forth, that are based on the ability of many of our tools to provide instantaneous real-time feedback, I mean, they never take account of this structural environment, right? And they never take account of, as I mentioned before, the role that, say, large food companies might be playing in a problem like obesity, or large energy companies might be playing in a problem like climate change, or you know, how the lack of investment into infrastructure might result in us not having a lot of opportunities to actually you know, engage in the kind of exercise that all of these apps are constantly promoting, right? So if we are not thinking about these problems from a much broader, holistic kind of structural perspective, we are going to end up in an environment where your every single action is being monitored and it is being assessed, and you are being constantly nudged to do something that you might not do otherwise. And that's what politics becomes, right? Where you know, we are trying to squeeze as much efficiency and performance from the current system without engaging in any re-examination of what politics and what, you know, our current system might be if only certain conditions were not in place, right? And that's what makes me quite suspicious of the some of the excitement and some of the rhetoric associated with this project. And in some sense, those of you who have studied history of technology and of attempts to regulate, you will know that a lot of the excitement for real-time regulation that we are currently seeing, it does go back to the initial ideas associated with cybernetics and the idea of regulation and control, for example, in itself, is a profoundly cybernetic idea. So in some sense, you can argue that some of the contemporary excitement about the uses of automation, and particularly the automation of governance, they're not in themselves new. What I would argue, however, is that you know, at least some of the cybernetic thinkers, I'm thinking of people like Stafford Beer, for example, did have a way to incorporate structural elements and other systems. It was not just a matter of keeping the status quo, regardless of what you might read in some of the critical accounts and histories of cybernetics. It was not just about keeping the status quo as it is. It was about introducing actually ways to measure how the status quo is being generated. So, I mean, the situation that we have right now is actually, I think, very serious in that We are, if you look at that essay, for example, by Tim O'Reilly, you would see that for him, the very first criteria for algorithmic regulation, defining whether the goal of the system to be regulated is well measured and well understood, he does not actually explain how it is to be measured and how it is to be understood, right? And of course, if you think about what politics used to be about, it was all about choosing the levels of problems, the levels of problem solving through which we would engage in solving a problem. It might be that it's all a matter of individual responsibility, right? It's all a matter of, as you know, a lot of people in the conservative tradition would say, it's all a matter of you feeling responsible for your own life, or it's a matter of someone else being responsible for you, whether it's the welfare state or whether it's you know, some kind of collective representative institution, right? But the levels at which the problems are tackled used to be very different, and that's what politics used to be. We used to debate actually which of those levels is better and associated with a very different type of politics. What's happening right now is in part because there is so much excitement about technology, about apps, about the ability to get things done through technology. We are entering a world where that debate is no longer as important as it used to be, in part because we by default are choosing the level that has more technology and has more you know, excitement associated with it, and that's the level of the individual. Right, so what I'm arguing is that yes, big data does smuggle a certain kind of politics, and that's not a politics that favors collectivity. It's not a it's not a politics that favors actually debates about the levels through which problems ought to be tackled. And by levels, I mean whether it's to be done collectively, whether it's to be done individually. And of course, I also don't want to give you the impression that all the problems in our lives are solely the problems of institutions. Right? I mean, clearly, there needs to be a role for knowing something about, you know, nutrition or exercise or energy or having some kind of literacy in all of the problems that currently plague the world. You cannot just completely outsource that competence to an app or to an institution. Just like you shouldn't outsource it to an institution, you shouldn't outsource it on app. But just to repeat what I've been saying already, we cannot assume that just because the technology does allow us to easily engage in tracking and monitoring one particular component of this system, this is where politics ought to happen. I think we have to challenge that view, right? And we have to constantly go and re-examine how we can actually engage in a different type of politics that, again, might be data intensive. And here I think we have to be very careful because some of the celebration, not just behind big data, but also behind social media and various platforms for self-organization, has to do with the fact that they do allow people to solve their own problems in a new manner, completely bypassing any institutions that might be ineffective or underfunded or so forth that they could have used previously. Right? And there is a lot of excitement in Silicon Valley, particularly about that ability of mobile technology and of social media to bring people together on the spot in real time to solve the problems that currently cannot be solved by their governments. Right, and you have a long list of examples of people dealing with the consequences of natural disasters and hurricanes and, you know, underfunded art institutions where instead of waiting for government donation, which never comes, people self-organize and fund that institution collectively through Kickstarter or any of the other platforms. I mean, that's the other sort of part of the emancipatory project that we are being asked to accept. I think my reaction to this is very ambiguous in that many of the institutions of the welfare state that we have had for a very long time, it's true that they're no longer effective and perhaps they have outlived their own usefulness. But I don't want to accept the bargain as is being offered to us by many people who celebrate many of these new platforms where people can come together, because what essentially it means is that the old part of the bargain where we pay taxes and we fund many of these institutions stays in place. It's just that the taxes never reaches those institutions, so we actually ask to also contribute money through Kickstarter and other platforms, right? So it's not the kind of novel model of sort of the common where we are moving away from traditional sovereignty and we are self-organizing into little groups and we are funding our own little platforms and institutions. No, we're actually keeping all of the old institutions and all of the old procedures and all of the old methods completely intact. We assume that the bureaucracy is there and it needs to be funded. We give the money, and then the money goes somewhere, probably to bail out the banks, right? And then we're being asked to contribute to fund the things that we are supposed to be funding through our taxes through new emancipatory projects like Kickstarter. I mean, the problem here is not with Kickstarter. The problem is here with the fact that we already paid for the infrastructure. We're being asked to pay again, right? And I think, in principle, I mean, there is nothing wrong with moving away from that old model where we did have to fund a lot of this social welfare institutions, which were not particularly effective, and right now can probably be provided in a somewhat different manner. With the use of much better technology, sensors, you know, the Internet of Things, all of those things carry immense emancipatory potential, and I'm not going to say that they don't. But in order for those emancipatory potential to be realized, we also need to start working on reforming the political end of the bargain. We cannot just assume that we can just keep the political infrastructure that we already had intact and then just add Kickstarter on top of it and suddenly we'll move to an entirely brand new world. I mean, that's not going to happen. And to figure out how exactly we ought to reform that other part of the government is not particularly of much interest to Silicon Valley, because Silicon Valley sees itself as as an enabler of profoundly disruptive new technologies and ways to communicate that mostly deal with self-organization at the other end, right? So it's platforms like Uber, Airbnb, and you know, Kickstarter, which are perfectly fine, and you know, with some with some unresolved issues which can be resolved quite easily, they are not to be feared necessarily. The problem is that someone still ought to be reforming the welfare state, right? Or getting rid of it, or doing something with it, or just switching to a moral way instead of worrying about what automation will do to our jobs. We just provide everyone with basic income and just have the machines do all the work for us. I mean, but we have to start thinking about ways in which the old political system can itself be remade into something else, because unless we do that, and I think we actually can do a lot of it now, again, with the help of big data, with the help of real-time analysis, with the help of the Internet of Things, with the help of real-time analytics, all of this stuff does allow for new types of efficiencies to be squeezed out of a system that you couldn't have squeezed out before. You know, I don't know if you know this work, but Frederick Jameson, one of the famous Marxist literary theorists, had an essay a few years ago where he basically said, I think, a very kind of funny, but also I think a very deep thing, where he said that if communism were to rebuild today, it would be rebuilt on the model of Walmart, right? And by that, he didn't mean exploitation and Walmart's ability to negotiate and very brutally with its suppliers, but the fact that it does rely on superb machine learning, data analytics, all sorts of sensor-powered technology in order to squeeze out the kind of efficiencies from the system that you couldn't have squeezed out before, right? And I think there is no harm in trying to think about how a different type of social organization might emerge with the help of those technologies. I just don't think that it's going to be built by Silicon Valley, right? And I don't want us to accept this, as I said, this very sore bargain where we don't do anything about new types of social organization, and we just accept the fact that, you know, now we can do more things more effectively with the same kind of resources. I mean, the fact that we can squeeze more resources from the same, you know, pool of people and our free time, I mean, in itself, yes, it can be celebrated, but I don't think that it should be the end goal of our emancipatory project, right? So I think the bigger question that we all have to start addressing, that they have to do with politics, right? And they have to do with the, we have to start questioning whether we are surrendering some of the responsibility for problem solving to the private sector, in part because the private sector, and the private sector I mean mostly Silicon Valley in this case, have positioned itself as a sector that can do things very quickly, very efficiently, with a lot of innovation, and they employ technology, and everyone loves technology because it's extremely sexy. So any politician now who has a choice of whether engaging in some kind of massive reform effort that might require fighting with lobbyists in Washington or regulating the work of some industry group that might have a lot of power in the capital, whether it's the food industry, whether it's the energy industry, or if that alternative is to build a nice app or sponsor a nice app or to promote a nice app that will more or less proclaim that it's also solving climate change or it's solving obesity or it's solving some other problem, they'll probably choose building the app, right? Because it will generate nice coverage in Wired magazine, it will get them invited to the TED conference, and it will get a lot of buzz on social media. Right? Even though the kind of political agenda and the kind of political, I think the idea of politics that it embeds in itself, once you start thinking about it, is actually very ugly. Right. So how do we analyze some of these efforts, which on first look very, they look very nice. They're very, they're full of potential. They're all built by young, talented coders, probably on this campus at Stanford or somewhere else, who all want to change the world. It's an effort that I think we should encourage. But again, we should also understand that that effort fits into very well into a particular political program, and that particular program does think of changing the world as an enterprise that is pursued by individuals, and not just by individuals, but by individual consumers, rather than by some kind of political collectivity, right? And it's how do we not just make all of this young people keen to change the world with apps aware of some of the costs and traps of this project, but also how do we articulate an alternative method through which they can engage in politics. I think that's one of the larger tasks for us today. Because again, I don't want to say that this effort, which I have at some point criticized as solutionism in my last book, I don't want to say that all of it is disingenuous or naive. I mean, some of it is naive, but it's not driven by bad intentions. And the question that I think we have to find an answer to is how do we come up with a model of social change that still relies on digital technology and that still relies on algorithms, big data, sensors, and so forth, but does not think of its output as an app or as a commercial product or as a commodity to be sold or traded, right? And I think we have failed so far. I mean, we see, we keep talking about Wikipedia as if it was, the solution to all of the world's problems, but its model, while, it works for Wikipedia, it's hard to figure out how to translate that model into something else, into other areas of life, right? And it's the same, more or less, with the idea of free software and open source software, which themselves have changed quite a lot in the kind of efforts that they're pursuing. So how do we articulate this alternative paradigm and what we can actually get some of the talented young people to do? I think that's the question we'll have to find an answer to. How much time do I have? The last point that I would like to address is, again, what happens to the data, right? Because one of the factors and one of the forces driving the real-time monitoring that I've been talking about at the very beginning, it's the fact that there are very strong incentives that are built into the system for us to monitor ourselves, right? And this, I think, is a problem that we have not yet grasped, because, again, this is presented to us as some kind of emancipation, in that the proposition is that if only you can monitor yourself and everything that you do, and then package it nicely, right? You can make money. And the idea is that, and you see it repeated more and more in Silicon Valley and also in Boston around MIT, where I live, you hear it more and more in various slogans like the data is the new asset class, or data becomes a new commodity, or you have to be able to take your data from the Googles and Facebook of this world and do with it whatever you want. And what is meant by that is put it on the market and sell it, right, in a way that is secure and that is also monetizable. Right, and that's presented to us as again as one of the ways in which we can probably survive or tackle some of the unfortunate consequences of automation and potential loss of jobs that it might lead to. So if you followed some of the discussions at the World Economic Forum in Davos earlier this year, you actually had tech executives there being on the record saying things along the lines of, well, we don't actually have a good answer to the problem of automation, but we do know that one way in which to mitigate the problem is at least to allow us to make money off of our own data. Right, and the argument there is framed along very populist lines. Right, it's framed along the lines of, well, if you don't monetize it, Google and Facebook will monetize it. So you'd better get there first, find a way to extract it from them, turn it into, you know, a commodity, and then put it on some kind of an auction system. Right, and all sorts of apps are currently being developed that will allow you to do it securely, which of course in itself builds into itself an incentive for you to constantly think of new ways and of new activities that can potentially be monitored and monetized, because you don't want to lose out on all of the potential value that you might gather by being as pervasive with your own self-surveillance as you can be, right? Because the value of your data is additive, right? And it's cumulative. It's the more data that you have and the more comprehensive it is, the more valuable it is, right? So we are being invited to this very bizarre situation where the logic is that the more apps for self-monitoring we install, the higher is the value of our data portfolio. Right, so, and then in a sense, the rest is very easy to imagine. I mean, you can think of all sorts of propositions for that data that are tied to geolocation or being tied to some contextual situation where, again, your phone becomes like a stockbroker for your data, where the idea is that, you know, whenever you're passing through a store and the store knows that you're likely to purchase something there, it purchases your data to sell you the most relevant ad, and then, you know, you get something in return, right? The idea that your data can be productive and you can make money off of it, I think, is a very profound insight, and that also why I think that the problem of privacy, as it's currently being posed to us, will probably be solved through this mechanism. In that, you know, leaving Google and Facebook aside, there are enough data entrepreneurs who do want to build a secure fence around your data for the sole reason that they want you to be able to sell it. If you cannot sell your data, then, you know, there is no market in data, right? So the idea that you want to build strong property rights around data itself is gaining a lot of supporters, and I think a lot of people will be pushing for it, and they will be pushing for it precisely because, again, it fits this vision of us being able to, first of all, limit the power of Google and Facebook, but also to reap off some of the benefits that can offset some of the dangers that might happen otherwise. with automation and so forth. The problem with this vision, of course, is that again, it promotes a certain type of politics, right? Where again, we are engaging in efforts around data solely as individuals, and not, and even as consumers, and not at all with any kind of political responsibility as citizens. Right? There is no understanding that there might be other ways and uses for this data, right? That might actually be needed for you know, the purposes of science or health or education or you name it. That once it's commodified, it will be very hard to harness that data for that particular reason, right? So in a sense, we are commodifying the kind of data that might otherwise be used very productively for reasons and projects that will be publicly oriented rather than privately oriented, as in, you know, some company wants that data, we want to get money, we establish a transaction, and it kind of erects some kind of enclosure around the data in much the same way as you can argue we have erected with excessive copyright around some of the cultural works, right? And then the question then becomes, to what extent we actually want to think about data as an asset, right? There is a guy, today is the 10th, so on April 12th, there is a guy in the Netherlands who is putting out all of his personal data on sale. So everything, his passwords, his email, his health records, his transportation records, everything that he has, he's putting up on an online auction, and you can come and bid for it, right? And buy all of the data that he will generate for the year ahead, right, on that auction. So it's happening in 2 days, right? And that, to me, it's a kind of, I mean, this particular project is an art project, right? But it's to me signifies a trend that we'll probably see more and more often, and it's that, well, people realize that some of their data in this new data economy has immense value, and if you can, why not just make some money off of it? If you don't care about, you know, privacy, why not do it? Right, and then you start entering very tricky moral and ethical issues in that, where should the limit be? I mean, should you allow people to sell all the data that they have? Or should you just allow a certain percentage of the data? And should you do it, should you allow them to do it knowing that some of that data will be used to completely personalize the experiences that they have, right? In some sense, creating the kind of path that they will be set upon in a way that they might not have been set upon if they did not share that data with the advertisers, right? And that does raise very interesting questions about autonomy. And my favorite example that I like to give is that, imagine that this guy who sells his data, well, in 2 days, right? Imagine what happens afterwards. So he sells his data, and imagine that there is a company that then shares his data with a bunch of other companies. So his, say, local supermarket suddenly knows some of his preferences and can monitor his preferences in real time, since they know his passwords and his data and, you know, some of his other personal details. And his local restaurant knows it as well, right? So imagine this guy goes to Google and just all of a sudden he just feels the impulse to experiment with his life and, you know, become a vegetarian or think about becoming a vegetarian. He just types into his Google search engine, should I become a vegetarian? Right, and that all it does, forget about the results that he gets, right? All it does is communicates an intent. That this particular guy living in this particular apartment, using this particular smartphone, going through this particular route to his work every day, is vulnerable to becoming a vegetarian or not becoming a vegetarian. He's on the you know, fence, right? And then imagine again, it's no longer that we are living in a world where the ads drop on us from television, right? I mean, this guy goes to work every day, right? And suddenly, all of a sudden, he sees a pop-up on his phone saying that his local supermarket will offer him discounts on meat products or on vegetable products. And he goes by his local steakhouse and he gets another offer saying that he'll get a discount on a steak, right? And again, the kind of interactions that are set off and the kind of options and paths that suddenly open up in our lives once more and more data is being shared, right? They are, of course, partly deterministic and partly they are the result of the very data that we share, right? I think it's also true that the kind of examples I've used now, they're very transparent. It's possible to, perhaps, knowing that you have shared that intent that you want to become a vegetarian, it becomes possible for you to be able to work back in time and understand that the kind of pop-up ad that you see on your phone offering you a discount at your local store is ultimately linked to the internet search that you've placed. But once you completely abandon, you know, as much data as you can, and you are in a mode of perpetual surveillance and perpetual monitoring, I don't think you'll have that transparency, and you will have no idea what's happening for with many of the choices that you make. And you might actually genuinely believe, you're actually making decisions. So imagine that after 3 months, that guy decides not to become a vegetarian, right? Can you conclusively say that he actually did it because he had thought about it very deeply, or that happened simply because the supermarket or the steakhouse happened to have a larger advertising budget than whoever it is that wanted him to be a vegetarian, right? Those are the kind of questions that, again, we didn't have to deal with, in part because we did not live in a world where our data was so easy to gather, but then also to package and then move across different steps in the system that, you know, structures our everyday life, right? And the kind of consequences that will happen as, again, the structural economic environment forces us to think of our data productively, in part because the opportunities for making money throughout the means are shrinking, right? As data becomes a productive asset, right? It does become something that we have to confront, right? And I'm not sure that the rhetoric that we've heard so far that treating data as an asset, enabling trades and data like you enable trades and other commodities without any kind of ethical or moral regime, regulatory regime attached to it, that we should do it just because it will undermine Google or Facebook and will earn us some money, I'm not sure that that's the right stance to make, right? Again, we have, for various reasons, and some of you might oppose them, but, you know, we have thought about regulating how we trade in other commodities. You know, we don't allow people to sell themselves into slavery. We don't allow people to do many other things with themselves, and we don't do that in part because we think that it might have a profound effect on their autonomy, right? And we don't generally want to give people the autonomy to give up their own autonomy, right? And I'm not sure that we should not be thinking along those lines when it comes to how we should structure the economic and political environment in which we think about data, right? But all of that is just to say that I think there are profound political and economic forces at play that structure how we collect data, that structure how we think about data, that structure how we then think about politics, given that we have all the data. And we have to somehow bring our political and economic and ethical and philosophical analysis to bear on the assessments of this otherwise wonderful and highly disruptive tools that we're being presented with every day. I mean, they might be very shiny and very disruptive, and they might accomplish quite a bit compared to the previous tools, but we should not lose sight of the fact that they're also smuggling, through the back door or not, a certain ways of doing politics and a certain ways of doing ethics, right? And I think we have to challenge the discourse of efficiency and innovation through which many of the technologies are being presented, and I think that's the only way in which we can actually still preserve some kind of politics that is a bit more ambitious than just asking the individual to adjust themselves to the system that is itself treated as fixed. Right? So I think I'll stop here, and I'll be happy to take questions. Thank you so much.
First of all, I really enjoy the latest Captain America movie, so be interested to see your reaction on that. Most of what you've talked about thus far has been about big data, about individual people.
Mm.
And when I think of Internet of Things, I think of things other than people as well, right?
Sure.
You know, putting sensors out in the environment and, you know, understanding temperature and motion of people and environmental things. How do these two things interact? Because a lot of those things are being used to do such things as urban planning and things that are, you could argue are socially beneficial.
Sure. Again, I think the question here is not really about whether something is socially beneficial or not. I think what we need to keep in mind is the kind of stories about causality that we often tell ourselves about the problems we're trying to solve, right? And it might be that gathering more data from more sensors and more sources will result in us getting a more complex picture about why certain things happen, right? Why, climate change happens, or why, congestion happens. But it also might be that the stories we'll get will actually be less reliable in that they will not be comprehensive, in that the sensors can only tell you part of the story, which is about the things that can be captured by sensors, right? So the story about congestion will tell you that congestion happens because, you know, there are lots of cars on the road, whatever, right? But it will not link it then to the kind of political and economic regulatory decisions that have resulted in this particular situation with so many cars and, you know, the fact that we do not have, more public transportation or whatever. Right? Those are questions that, again, can be asked by intelligent observers, right? Whether they are being asked, I don't know, right? But, again, my critique, if you can call it that, so far is mostly about the lack of comprehensiveness that is embedded in many of these systems, right? So, I mean, yes, it's useful data if you know its limitations, right? And if you can take those limitations and still arrive at the model of causality that goes beyond just the individual interactions of individual actors, right? And still try to figure out the role that money plays or the industry plays or lobbying plays or other factors play that are very hard to analyze at the level of sensors. You know, we don't make lobbyists via sensors, unfortunately, so we don't know about how they self-organize. Right, but again, it's not. Even though I know that a lot of the things I've said had to do with the individuals, but I don't think that that's a critique that applies to individuals only. It applies to individuals in as much as, you know, if you study certain literature on governance and politics, you will see that the kind of trend I've described does fit one particular model of governance, which would be the neoliberal model of governance, where the responsibility is believed to be with the individual, and you have to work on yourself in order to, solve your own problems, right? And it's through that sort of type of critique that I arrived at this discussion of whether, the fact that we have the means, because the sensors, we are buying them, right? And they also built and integrated into a much broader ecosystem of us being on social networks and sharing some of the data. I mean, the story is much more complex that I could have told, right? But I mean, it's clearly not just, a bunch of sensors out there. I mean, there are entire business logics that are driving this, right? And but again, it's so. I mean, I take your point. That, again, I'm not saying that it's not socially beneficial. It's socially beneficial if used with caution and a lot of footnotes that are not forgotten as this idea is incorporated into governance processes. But once you start operating with ideas like algorithmic regulation, the very idea that it's kind of supposed to be running almost automatically on autopilot makes me question whether, all of those disclaimers that I've made will still be kept in mind, right? And when we do see ideas like the Federal Reserve as the kind of paradigm of an independent governance mechanism that is not at all influenced by structural factors, I just find it laughable, right? Because again, it's something that starts from theory and completely forgets what has happened in the last 40 or 50 years in terms of the Federal Reserve vis-a-vis Wall Street, right? So, and the fact that we keep to lose sight of the structural perspective, it just terrifies me, but yeah.
Here in Silicon Valley, high-tech, one of the hottest topics is the Internet of Things. Uh-huh. Internet of Things. And that includes home monitoring systems, e-health, connected car, wearable technologies, etc.
Sure.
One of the things that I was hoping that you would address, I did not get, is what I'm going to ask you now.
Mm.
The big issue in the Internet of Things is privacy and security.
Mm-hmm.
Let me distinguish between the two because they're very different and not the same. Privacy is guaranteeing that your information will not be sold or disseminated by the data collector. Security is the concern that your information will not be intercepted and maliciously used.
Mm-hmm.
Can you please address each of these two major concerns for the global Internet of Things market?
But what do you mean by address?
Just briefly comment on what is your opinion of the state today of privacy and security.
Sure. Well, the idea of the Internet of Things presumes that there is some kind of commonality to the state of security and privacy in autonomous self-driving cars and the trash bins that have sensors built into them. I'm just not sure that that's the assumption we have to be making. So, I come to this questions from a somewhat different perspective. To me, the fact that they have connectivity in them and sensors in them, and then you can analyze them through the perspective of some kind of unitary force called the Internet of Things, to me it seems very bizarre, because again, I think that there is nothing inherent to the name the Internet of Things that will result in a singular experience of security or of privacy in many of those systems. So it's very hard for me to give you an answer. I mean, we can try to talk about individual technologies, perhaps, but even there, I don't know how much detail I can give you. I'm not a security expert, so I wouldn't give you stats on to how many trash bins connected to the internet have been hacked in the last 2 years. Like that's the kind of stat I'm not going to give you. On the other hand, my general thesis, if you want to know about the Internet of Things, is that more or less it's the spread of financial markets and financialization into everyday built environment, into more or less everyday life. You want to be able to capture through the process of building sensors and this connectivity into virtually every object, you want to capture your specific interaction with it and then add it to your overall data profile and then turn it into a commodity. So at the individual level, for me, it's clear what's driving it, and it's precisely the need to be able to be comprehensive in sucking out as much data about your interaction with your everyday life. Because again, look, for me, it's absolutely clear that in 5 years, Google and Facebook will diversify beyond advertising, and they will enter the field that makes most sense for them given the kind of data they have been accumulating, and that field is banking and insurance. The more data they can accumulate about your everyday life, the better they can price risk. And if you look at what Google has been doing, and it has been buying smoke detectors in your bedroom, getting self-driving cars, getting Google Glass, getting everything that more or less follows you as you wake up and go through the day. And once you have the ability to analyze what it is that you do on a daily basis, how it is that you drive, how likely it is that you will have a fire in your home, I mean, then you can easily price risk for insurance. You can easily price risk for, loans and so forth. So for me, the fact that you see more and more sensors and more ways to capture data, and that these companies that have been collecting data more or less about our searches and social networking activities are now extending into other types of data collection, to me, it makes perfect sense. With regards to privacy and security, I mean, they will... they'll make sure they can suck out as much data as you can, then they'll do it through terms and conditions as they have done before. Whether there will be third parties intercepting that data, I mean, I can only give you a banal answer. I think that yes, the technical details of how exactly that will be done for smart smoke detectors and how it will differ from self-driving cars, I just can't give you.
Thanks for the interesting talk. I was struck by the point that you made about how this new vision encourages us to see the value of our data as relevant to our role as private individual consumers as opposed to as citizens in the public sphere. But I think there's another political dimension of this that I didn't hear addressed in your talk, and I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on, and that is the fact that the language of talking about it as my data is inherently misleading as well, because to the extent that the data is complete and accurate, it's always going to be relational, and it's always going to disclose information about, if it's medical and health information about me or genetic information about me, it's also about my parents, my brothers, my children. The data about my purchases is also data about my travel companions and what they do and what activities they prefer. It's information about the people I buy gifts for.
Sure.
It's information about the people I drink with. Mm-hmm. So there's an encouragement here to think of this as my property, my risk, which I then am making a choice to hand over to someone else for payment.
Sure.
But what I am doing is I am disclosing information about networks of individuals who don't have this choice. And so the language of I get of my data, I think, is very dangerous.
Sure. Yeah, and I fully agree with you. But I think the premise, I think we need to go even further than that. I think we have to ask whether, as a sort of basic category, we can even because what Silicon Valley will tell you is that we'll build a nice app for negotiating with your parents for the data you're about to sell, and we'll find a way to get a monetary account sort of calculated that will compensate them for the psychological damage they will incur as you sell the data. I mean, that's how Wall Street works, right? They'll be able to find data derivatives that will compensate everyone for whatever risks that might emerge from the data about to sell. So I don't doubt the inventiveness. I think we need to make a political decision as to, assuming that they would be able to do that, whether we still want to treat data as an asset class, or whether we want to treat it as, I don't want to get into a long debate about the notion of the common versus the commons and so forth, but we have to think about alternative ownership models will not lead to data being treated as a commodity in the first place, right? So, I mean, I fully agree with you that we should not be thinking about it as my own data, as confusing as it might sound to some of us, and particularly to people who are trying to get that data from the Googles and Facebook of this world, who have kind of, taken it from us very violently. It's just that I don't think that the answer to it is to turn it into a commodity. And then the question is, what kind of a total public kind of data pool we can imagine, and who will run it, right? That will not result in NSA using this data for their activities. Because, technically, we already have all this data collected in one place, and it is run by the government, right? It just happens not to be acting in our own interest necessarily, right? And then the question is, so if it's not the government, and if it's not an asset class, right, what is it? And I think, while there are some examples locally in some countries, in Italy, for example, of how you can run common ownership structures where it's neither the public nor the private in charge of it, how exactly you translate that model into data is a big issue, but I don't think it's something that we cannot solve. I don't think also a lot of work has been done on that so far. So
you want us to imagine a social
politics of big data might look like. And it seems like that would require not only making these NSA data sets available to the NSF, but actually, and to other more constructive government institutions, but to actually make powerful decisions based upon that data. So perhaps, you know, not only would you need data about environmental pollutants of various sorts, you'd need to turn around and tax based on the readings you're getting from all the sensors. You need to not only, you know, have data about how much everything costs, but you need to turn around and say, well, actually, we're going to try to enforce better labor standards now that we know where every little object came from. Or, you know, we know what everyone's listening to music-wise, so let's pay all the artists based on that data set out of the public. So we can sort of imagine the set of socially constructive things you could try to do there. And I think a lot of people in San Francisco and Silicon Valley, a lot of engineers would get excited about these kinds of ideas. But the problem that I see here is that the politics of the United States is totally unwelcoming to any exploration of any of those ideas. And there are a lot of other places in the world that would be much more interested in those kinds of technological experiments, but they're just not in the same place. And so I wonder, is this an accident of geography somehow? You know, Silicon Valley happened in the place that happened to be hostile to social democracy, the United States, or is it actually that in some way it came out of the alternative political vision that lets people actually do other things more easily if you don't have government rules taxing people and trying to make the world better? And so I guess that's the puzzle that I see in this.
Yeah, I just want to clarify that, and again, you gave several examples at the beginning of what that project might look like, and I'm not sure that I actually share all of them. I think someone like Jaron Lanier, for example, would. So the idea I didn't say, I don't think that it necessarily follows from my project that we could will use that data to compensate the artists based on, I don't know, how many times people listen to the Spotify. I know. But again, that's not what I'm saying. So I mean, someone like Jaron Lanier, for example, is saying that, you know, if you're wearing a dress and someone likes the dress and goes on to Amazon and buys the same dress, you should get a cut from whoever makes that dress, right? And that's sort of his model for how you can get some of the money from the Google side. That's not what I'm saying. Actually, I don't think that's... I think that's actually neoliberalism on steroids, to be honest, right? Because, again, it's not the model. It's commodifying all social relationships where, you know, you'll be going and thinking about what it is that I can do to get the biggest payout based on, you know, on whatever the sensors are. But, you know, there was, I mean, I don't want to repeat my talk, but, you know, there was some kind of level of radicality to my proposal. So with that, we can, that I think is what we were getting at, that, like, it was a bit too radical for the political climate of the U.S. and the Silicon Valley being what it is, it just doesn't look very feasible and why it's the case. So, and I think that's... I mean, that's clearly an issue, that's clearly a problem, but I mean, what can you do? I mean, the only thing you can do is try to go and decipher and try to identify the ways in which problems and issues that used to be political get depoliticized and turned into apparently self-evident and self-obvious things that, you know, disruption is good, innovation is good, and we have to make things that are efficient. And I mean, there is a kind of ideological discourse happening, partly coming out of Silicon Valley, that is trying to, convince us in part that algorithmic regulation is good. Why? Because it's efficient. Why is it efficient? Because that's how the Federal Reserve works. Then you look at the Federal Reserve, and it doesn't look particularly efficient. And you know, what do you do then? I don't know. But people get away with such statements, right? And such proposals and such arguments. And I think all we can do is make it harder for them to get away with them. I'm not saying that amounts to an entire political process or project, but that's something that can be done. I don't think that that in itself will necessarily radicalize the political commitments, but it might also orient or at least push some of the social movements that are beginning to emerge around these issues in political directions that they might not go otherwise. You work with the EFF, right? So you know some of the, probably some of the critiques I, for example, launched against the idea of internet freedom. Like, I just think it's a very bad, like, idea. Like, not as a, like, I don't, and it's not because I hate freedom, but because I think that as it's framed discursively, something like internet freedom actually depoliticizes the kind of debates we need to be having, because we have to be questioning the actual politics of some of the proposed reforms and not defending something that looks so ambiguous and often ends up promoting the interests of big Silicon Valley firms who also want their own internet freedom. And, you know, telecoms want their own internet freedom, which for them means freedom from government regulation. And there are all sorts of ambiguities built into such terms, and all you can do is just to point out what they are, hoping that some of the social movements that did try to embrace causes of internet freedom, like Anonymous and, you know, many others, or proto-social movements, if you will, you know, don't get derailed into projects and directions where they probably don't have to go. But I'm not saying that that will exhaust all the options of how we can do politics. I'm just speaking for myself.
Completely in defense of the concept of internet freedom, I'm not sure it's any worse than the concept of freedom in the first place, which is itself like very ambiguous.
Well,
well,
I just believe in math. You take two ambiguous concepts, you like add them up, and you end up with something that was even more ambiguous. But they just
me. We have time for one more question.
Thank you again. I really enjoyed your talk. I'm a data scientist and I work in tech and I know something about algorithms. And I'm interested in the bifurcation that inevitably ends up happening between critics who are, you know, assailing the ethics and the underlying political and social world implications of new technology, and the individuals who are actually developing these new technologies. Mm. And instead of, I think it's great that you're speaking at a center for ethics, why not bring this critique to the individuals who are pushing the world forward into this world of algorithmic regulation, who are developing these new technologies? Is there any benefit in talking to such people, or do you think they're too deeply enmeshed in the system to be able to envision radically different realities?
You know, it's a great question. And, you know, at some level, I think that, you know, clearly there is space and there is a need to politicize, you know, design and data science in more or less the same way as computer science was politicized in the early 70s, you know, by associating it with, you know, potentially the defense industry and the military-industrial complex and then whatnot. I mean, and that is what has led to the establishment of the computers for socialist, computer professionals for social responsibility. I mean, all sorts of other bodies that try to get computer professionals to think about the ethical and moral implications of their work. I mean, I haven't seen that, to be honest, done at the same level or scale yet with data science, but I'm sure there will be institutes and panels for, you know, data science ethics and whatnot. The problem there is that, of course, you know, it's hard. Like, I don't know how much space you have as a data scientist within a big company to do anything. And then, you know, the making that argument to Eric Schmidt is not going to make any difference, because, you know, he has shareholders that, you know, who mostly happen to be the co-founders, but still, you know, and he responds to them, right? So, I mean, in some sense, and then, you know, of course, they'll have their own responses through business ethics and whatnot, but the challenge here is that, and that's the same challenge I've run into when I try to, I've also been talking a lot about design, and there is a lot of stuff in my last book about design and alternatives, way to design things that might be more ethical and promote at least some more reflection on the political situation. And the response you get is, like, why talk to designers? Designers just follow the orders in the company. And, you know, and that's almost a valid response, right? And then you end up in a situation where you have to justify yourself and say, well, I'm not only talking to designers, I'm also trying to create some kind of new political consciousness in consumers who demand different products that are designed differently, and then you again end up in the same argument as to whether products designed differently actually matter. You know, whether you end up in a situation like, I don't know, fair trade coffee, where you think you're making a difference, but who knows, right? And that's the same difference you might get if you get products that are ethically designed, but, you know, they make everyone sleep well at night, but, you know, they don't actually result in any systematic change politically, right? And that's also another issue. But no, otherwise, I agree with you. I mean, there needs to be a conversation with the actual people building those tools. Just that I'm being Eastern European, I'm cynical enough to know that, you know, your dissent will be expressed individually in your basement building things that have nothing to do with your current job, probably, right? And that's not the kind of avenue for dissent that we necessarily want to encourage.
Before we thank Evgeny, I want to just comment that we are an ethics center within Silicon Valley, and we absolutely want to talk to the practitioners. And there are events now around the country on big data ethics, and I think the practitioners have to be involved in those conversations, whether they can act, I think you're absolutely right, they can't act alone, or that's not going to be the only solution, but if they don't explain big data ethics to the rest of us, we can't help make those political decisions that he's talking about. So please come and talk to us, and then we'll reach out to him.
So please join us for a reception to continue the conversation just outside the hallway. Please join me in thanking Evgeny Markov.
Thank you so much.